At the legislature today, after natural catastrophes in 2012, homeowners found their insurance canceled. Today in the Senate, the effort begins to correct that. The House was still today as lawmakers head into session tonight, so we'll visit this office in the basement of the state capitol that keeps you and legislators informed about the legislative process. This is the Legislature Today. Good evening, I'm Beth Voorhees. The Secretary of the Department of Transportation gave his State of the Highways address to the Senate Committee on Transportation, updating members about funding, construction, and other department issues. Secretary Paul Maddox says federal funding is going to be a major focus for his office in the near future. But as Ashton Mara reports, lawmakers are considering some local fixes to ease the state's burden.
Economic development. If you're not improving your infrastructure, building new roads, building new bridges, you're not investing in the future.
Secretary Maddox says funding the state's roadways should be a top priority for lawmakers, and it's his job to give them a perspective on where the department stands.
One of the main points I wanted to make to our committee was the fact that our paving cycle is just getting way away from us, that we're currently at 28 years on average for our paving cycle, and we need to be at a 12-year paving cycle.
Right now, Maddox says they're keeping their head above water, maintaining the state's roads. But according to findings of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Commission on Highways, to expand that system with new roads or bridges would take an additional $1.3 billion every year. Currently, state road funding comes from three sources: the gasoline tax, registration fees, and a tax on newly purchased vehicles. Maddox predicts those revenue sources will remain consistent over the next 5 years, but Transportation Committee Chair Senator Bob Beach says state roads are quickly becoming an underfunded liability.
So although those things are remaining flat, inflation's eating into it, as the Secretary alluded to, and we have 30% less buying power than we did 10 years ago.
The Blue Ribbon Commission is still working to finalize its recommendations for new revenue sources, but Maddox says he isn't proposing legislation this session to take on the funding issue.
One of the things that I would recommend is let's wait and see what the Federal Highway Administration does. Their current legislation expires October 1st of this year. Let's see how they address it over the summer and the fall and see if they give us continuing resolutions or if they address the federal funding issue.
Maddox says then the state can better assess any federal funding gap. But some lawmakers want to look for solutions now. During the meeting, Senator Bill Cole suggested pushing some of the funding responsibility down to the county and city level, which Maddox says dozens of states already do.
I think it's a great idea if you give the local government some means to raise revenue, or at least to bring additional revenue to the table so that we could work with them in getting some of the projects they feel are critical for their area to grow.
Beach says legislation to give that local control is being talked about and may be introduced during this session.
Potentially what you would see is that the county commission in those individual counties, and this is just a tool in the toolbox, would develop a road program, develop a plan for new roads in their area. Then they would submit that proposal to the Department of Highways. They would then have to sign off on it. So then it goes back home for public hearings, and then ultimately the county commission will be able to sign off on those new roads or bridges in their communities.
Beach says the legislation could also be expanded upon, allowing counties and municipalities to help fund water, sewer, and even broadband internet expansion projects. Beach expects the Blue Ribbon Commission's finalized report to come out this month. Then, he says, the governor will likely propose legislation for additional road funding. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ashton Mara in the Senate.
On the floor today, senators introduced legislation to protect homeowners from canceled insurance policies after a natural disaster.
3 p.m. in 208 West.
Senate Bill 349 prohibits the non-renewal or cancellation of a homeowner's property insurance for claims filed after a natural disaster. The bill was written in response to homeowner concerns after the derecho and Hurricane Sandy ravaged the state within 6 months of one another. Insurance companies were canceling or refusing to renew the policies of some West Virginians affected by both storms. This legislation bars them from continuing those practices if the claims are a result of a natural cause, like floods, ice, snow, or extreme temperatures. The bill's lead sponsor, Senator Greg Tucker, says it's a result of the work of an interim judiciary committee.
What we just felt it was unfair for someone to lose their insurance because of something that they had no control over. Now, of course, they're still going to be required to maintain their property, and if the loss is a result of the failure to maintain property, then that'll be exempted out. But we want to protect the typical West Virginia homeowner that keeps his property up, his or her property up, and we just felt it was the fair thing to do.
Tucker says this bill does not apply to businesses that experience cancellations, but legislators may look into that aspect in the future. The chemical leak has impacted the lives of over 300,000 West Virginians, and the legislature is not immune. The House of Delegates moved around committee meetings and rescheduled the floor session to this evening to allow members from out of town to get to Charleston. However, as Aaron Payne reports, other functions in the Capitol continue unimpeded.
At 11 a.m. Tuesday, the normal time for the House floor session, there was nothing to be found except for empty chairs and a few doormen. Due to the chemical leak, the House decided to reconvene at 6 p.m. to give delegates from the northern and eastern panhandle a chance to get back to Charleston. While the legislature's process has been slowed due to the chemical leak, one office down in the basement continues its function of keeping the public informed.
This is the Legislative Reference and Information Center. We're essentially called the Office of Public Information or Legislative Information.
Besides helping the press and the public keep up with the activities of the legislature, the office serves other functions such as housing older legislative archives, taking photos of events, producing a newsletter, and helping legislators from all parties produce informative releases for their constituents. One of the main functions is keeping the website updated.
We're staffed with two full-time writers, two per diem writers during session. And this year, we have two interns from Marshall and WVU, respectively, that help us, for college credit, obviously, help us help the members. Because what you see is the Capitol Press Corps has been getting smaller and smaller every year, and some of the newspapers around the state don't have the resources to send reporters to the Capitol. So we go ahead and help send basic information. The West Virginia legislature has a very nice website that disseminates information to the public, where a lot of people from around the state can't obviously come down to Charleston to see the day-to-day operations of the legislature. So we make sure that that information is readily available. We have a blog on the website that updates every day. Every time one of the chambers goes in, we say what they did, bills introduced, bills that are on the calendar, resolutions, whatever business is going on.
John Tice, the web and graphic designer for the office, makes sure the website is ready every day so that the public can follow along with the legislative process from the beginning, right along with the legislators.
In recent years, we've added streaming audio. That's one of our most popular links and something that's helped us connect to the public. We have audio for both chambers and for all major committee rooms. Bill status is where we have all of our bills. You know, we get about 2,000 bills introduced every single year, and we have legislation from 1993 through the current year. So we have over two decades worth of bills and corresponding, you know, information and content with those.
The bill status page allows visitors to track the process of legislation from the introduction to committees and finally the vote on the floor. However, the website is not just for political experts. In fact, as Tice explains, one of the most popular pages is a simple breakdown of the legislative process.
One of our most popular pages, if you do a Google search for us, is How a Bill Becomes Law. which, and I'm not really sure, maybe we just have really good search engine information on it, but this is almost the default how a bill becomes law for the entire world. And I'm not even exaggerating. And this is the one people go to learn how a bill becomes law. It's very, very basic. It's only a summary of the brochure that this office publishes, how a bill becomes law. And but this page gets a lot of hits from all over the country.
While the office has vast resources and a knowledgeable staff, Ross says that he hopes the service is being publicized.
I'm not sure how well known this resource is, so please use the website. There are 1-800 numbers to call for information. We're listed in the book. If you have any questions whatsoever about what's going on at the legislature, we have a full staff that is here and ready and willing to assist any questions, answering any questions that anyone might have.
The web address for the office is www.legis.state.wv.us. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Aaron Payne at the Capitol.
In a moment, we'll talk with the President of the Senate. First, here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the Senate today. Among the bills introduced in the Senate today, Senate Bill 338, the governor's bill to extend the West Virginia Tourism Development Act program permanently and remove the requirement that a consulting firm must review proposed projects and to increase tax credit amounts for projects located on state and federal recreational property. Senate Bill 340, to create a certification process for emergency medical technician industrial to practice only on industrial property. Senate Bill 349 prohibits the non-renewal or cancellation of a property insurance coverage policy as a result of certain claims arising from natural disasters. And Senate Bill 350 to require the Commissioner of Agriculture to propose rules for the West Virginia Department of Agriculture Rural Rehabilitation Loan Program. The rules must prohibit department employees and loan committee members and their immediate family members from receiving program loans. Our guest tonight was re-elected Senate President on January 9, 2013, having previously served a one-year term as Senate President after being elected West Virginia's first and only acting Senate President. Jeff Kessler was first appointed in 1997 and first elected in 1998. He is an attorney from Glendale in Marshall County. Mr. President, welcome.
Good evening.
First of all, let's talk about this chemical spill and what effects it may have on legislation and action this session. You know, nobody seems to like regulation until something isn't regulated, and then people want it regulated. What type of regulation would you support? Do you think the legislature should talk about?
Well, you know, it's obvious that there were some serious flaws in the current law on several fronts. Number one, if you recall, we had the Sago disaster a few years ago, and then the release of some chemicals down at the Bear facility in 2008. We immediately implemented some notification protocols so that if there was a leak or a disaster, that there was a requirement to report it to the appropriate government officials, 911, Homeland Security, whoever it may be, MSHA, OSHA, whoever, within a 15-minute time frame. That dealt with the chemical front basically on only for facilities that manufactured or produced something. In this instance, it was a warehousing or storage facility, so there was no production, so that notification may not have applied. Clearly, doesn't matter whether or not you're manufacturing 50,000 gallons of kerosene or if it's sitting in a holding tank and just being stored. It has the potential, if leaked within a water intake, to create a huge crisis or a huge disruption of your water source. So it's important, I think, that we look at expanding the scope of the notification, early notification, to any type of substance that may, in fact, upon release, if it's due to proximity next to a water resource intake, that it be reported promptly. We may also look at maybe some setback areas and at least inspections of those facilities on a rotating basis, regular basis, so that if we need to ensure that they are being stored or held in such type of containment areas, that there's little or no, hopefully no, chance of a leak or an exposure, or if a leak does happen, it can be limited. Mm-hmm. What happened here was terrible. You know, my majority leader pointed out, I've done some research that found that there was a Senator Unger found that in Massachusetts a few years ago, that there was a molasses leak into their water intake in one of their towns, and it just crippled it because all that gummy molasses. Now, most folks wouldn't think that molasses is a hazardous substance of any kind, but you put olive oil, anything too much into a water system, and it can really create a real disruption. And thankfully, it does not appear to be a high hazardous waste that was being stored in the Freedom Facility. Otherwise, we could have had a real nightmare on our hands.
Can the legislature get involved in risk assessment and direct the DEP or other agencies to really take a look at our waterways? What is lining the riverbanks of our waterways?
Well, I think the first thing they need to do is do an inventory.
Okay.
They need to inventory what type of facilities are within particularly our water intake, because once it gets drawn into that facility and distributed throughout our communities, that's where the potential for real damage and disaster can occur. So we need to know what's there and in what quantities, and if it is released, what type of containment measures they have to secure it, whether it's cathodically protected steel with, rubber rubber liners, et cetera.
That specification, sure.
Well, you can do that to make sure those facilities are safe, mm-hmm. and if, in fact, there is a leak of any kind that triggers an alarm, that notifies the appropriate public officials so they can go in and contain it so that there is no disruption. So it's early detection, containment, and knowing what's there.
You're from an area of the state where there is a lot of natural gas drilling using hydraulic fracturing. Are you confident that the chemicals used in that process is not contaminating water?
Yes, I am. I have not seen any real there's not been any real reports of that occurring. The activity's gone on at an extremely high level. If done right, proper casing, proper cementing, proper disposal, collection and disposal, that it can be done safely in an environmentally safe manner. And if they do not, the accidents we usually have found of when people have taken shortcuts. So when they take shortcuts, they need to be punished, prosecuted, and put in jail, and or have their business license taken. And that's really what's occurred with the enforcement measures when there have been accidents that need to be detected, reported, and if done deliberately, prosecuted.
All right, let's move on.
Sure.
You are all about the future fund this session, so state your case. Why do you think the state needs a future fund?
Well, a future fund is a mineral trust fund, an endowment fund. West Virginia has been historically, mineral rich, but if you look at our rankings and many of the most important per capita incomes, we're at the bottom of the list, 49th and 50th. And those counties that have produced the most minerals, particularly the southern counties in the state, the Boone, McDowell, Mingos, that have produced the most coal in our state, are some of the poorest counties in our poorest state. Mm-hmm. I keep saying that I call it sort of the what if, why not fund. That if we had just taken a few pennies of every ton of coal that came out of our ground, set it over in a savings account and sat it there for a period of time, we would be the richest state in the union instead of, in many respects, the poorest. That times have and we need to change that. As I look around and see we have this new energy opportunity with the Marcellus shale boom, then why don't we take a portion of the increased amount of volume of tax dollars, severance tax dollars that we're going to see, and set it in a similar account. Had we done it, what if had we done this in 1975, just taken 1% of our coal severance tax dollars and put it in such a fund, mm-hmm. today we'd have $7.9 billion, nearly $8 billion. If you're earning 10% interest on that, that's $800 million. Boy, whatever. How easy would it be to balance our budget this year if we had another $800 million? Mm-hmm. People look around and say, we can't do the things with the roads. We need $1 billion to bring them up to snuff. We don't have the money.
No.
But if we had $8 billion and we had in the bank an $800 million coming in every year in interest, we could take a $500 million this year, $500 million this next year, 2 years every road in this state's fixed.
A couple of questions. Does it affect the rainy day fund?
No, it doesn't affect it. The rainy day fund has about $1 billion in it now. Mm-hmm. The rainy day fund is for budget shortfalls, which we're having a small one this year, and also for natural disasters. rain, floods, pestilence, snowstorms, derechos, things of that nature. Yeah. But $1 billion is a lot of money to have in that fund. It's more than well adequately capitalized. The biggest time we've used it during the Governor Wise years was when we had the southern floods, I think, under Governor Wise, and we only spent $20 million of it.
Okay.
So we've got plenty of money in that one.
Another question. We've got budget holes.
Sure.
If you start saving money, then you don't have the money to spend on the needed things that the state agencies and state government needs
to
spend
it on. Here's the beauty of, but again, we're always playing from behind in this state. We've never gotten ahead, and we've never created the wealth that we can based upon the simple law of supply and demand, that we have something in enormous supply that's in great demand, and there's no reason to give it away. I'm projecting under my bill that we won't touch a dime of the current revenue estimates. For instance, the bill I put in before used the 2009, severance tax dollars. It would only be anything over and above that. So I'm looking at the projections for this year and next year, which are the two tough budget years. And if it's $100 million they've got in the budget, in their budget estimates, projections, if that's what they expect the gas severance tax to be, that'll be the cutoff point. We will only start saving anything and above that. So it will only be really banking on the fact that I think that our estimates are very conservative, and I expect the boon to be exponentially bigger than what's been projected. So if it goes $200 million instead of we've only expecting $100 million, do we need to spend that entire extra $100 million, or can we take $25 million of it, set it over here, and still have this $75 million to spend?
Does this take a constitutional amendment by voters?
No, what I'd like to do is this, set it up statutorily along the lines of what I've talked about, and then have a constitutional amendment on how the money can be spent once it reaches a certain level or once it is there. Because I don't think it should be used for pet projects. It should be used for infrastructure, education enhancements, economic development, and tax relief for the people of this state. People say, well, we'd love to get rid of the business inventory tax. I would too. $220 million. Where are we going to come up with it? If you had a fund of this nature set up over a 10 or a decade from now, we may be able to do away with it. But you can, and in Alaska, people that live there, they've got $46 billion in there. Every single man, woman, and child gets a check just for being an Alaska resident based upon what they've done with their oil reserve.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are going to continue watching this issue. Do you feel confident that it's going to move forward very quickly?
I do. I really do.
Well, we'll talk to you about that on the floor. And thank you very much, Senate President Jeff Kessler.
Happy to be here.
And here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the House today. Among the bills introduced in the House today, House Bill 4147 relating to emergency preparedness, House Bill 4148 repealing the Strategic Research and Development Tax Credit, House Bill 4151, the governor's bill relating to military members and their spouses who obtain licensure through professional boards, House Bill 4152, the governor's bill requiring all operators of underground facilities to participate in the one-call system, House Bill 4156, creating the Safe and Efficient Parkways Act, House Bill 4162, relating to the Local Solution Dropout Prevention and Recovery Innovation Zone Act, House Bill 4163, requiring outpatient surgical facilities to meet the same facility and surgical standards as ambulatory surgical facilities, House Bill 4165, authorizing the Public Service Commission to regulate broadband services, House Bill 4166, exempting municipal court judges from fees for application and license to carry concealed weapons, House Bill 4167, increasing the criminal penalties for damage to a cemetery or graveyard, and House Bill 4168, requiring materials, supplies, equipment, and other items purchased by the state and its agencies be made in the United States. This has been the Legislature Today. Tomorrow, we'll speak with the new Speaker of the House of Delegates, Tim Miley, from Harrison County. On Thursday, the Republican response to last week's State of the State address. Joining us will be the minority leaders of the House and Senate, Senator Mike Hall of Putnam County, and Delegate Tim Armstead of Kanawha County, as they discuss the Republican agenda at this session. We welcome your comments. You can send them to feedback at wvpublic.org. I'm Beth Voorhees. Thanks for joining us. Good night.